This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is Matt Kennedy, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
To Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry. This is The Path to Authenticity. So one of the things I really appreciate with this show is once in a while I'll have someone who will reach out and ask to be a guest. So a few weeks ago I had an artist on and she was talking about this gallery in Pasadena, California, where she submitted and sold some of her work. And the gallery owner listened to the podcast and reached out to me. His name's Matt Kennedy. Quite an intelligent guy who we had a conversation a few weeks ago, a couple days before Thanksgiving. And we talked and talked and talked. So this is the first part of our conversation. I broke it up into two episodes. We cover a lot of ground over the course of a couple hours. The first half of that is in this episode 99. Then we're going to have a special episode next week that kind of goes through some of the highlights of the first 100 episodes. Then episode 101 will be around the end of the month again with Matt. So we had a great conversation. He was a pleasure. We went in all sorts of directions. Again, really intelligent guy who could talk about just about anything. And anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Matt Kennedy. Tuesday before Thanksgiving, you know, and we're in the midst of all this crazy COVID stuff. I don't know about you, but the people in my world are a little disappointed they can't spend Thanksgiving together. And yeah, this has really been a weird year, hasn't it?
It has been. California's maybe a little bit different than most other places, Los Angeles especially, in that a lot of people kind of come to LA to get away from their families. So there's a little bit of that. So maybe there's some relief to be had there. But I think also it depends what age you are too and where you are in your journey, so to speak. But yeah, I think that after, you know, 9 months of quarantine, basically, for a lot of people, that they probably would have been hoping that they could finally get out and see people. And, you know, Thanksgiving is one of those holidays, which is, there's really not a lot of downside to, except for, you know, the arguments and the politics and things like that. But, you know, because it's such an eating holiday, there's a lot more docility, I think, to be had sometimes, but, it's going to be interesting for sure. And certainly we don't want to see, spikes beyond what we've already been seeing in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad enough already, but why don't you tell everybody what you do? So I guess I'll kind of tee that up by saying a few episodes ago, I had Elena Olander, who is an artist based in Jacksonville, and she talked about a show that she participated in that was at your gallery, right?
Yes. Yes, she was in the coaster show. It was the 8th annual coaster show. She was new to us. I was unfamiliar with her work, and she submitted. And the way the show works is all the pieces are on 4-inch, basically beer coasters. But it can be either the usual pressed, you know, board that you see in a bar. It can be printed on one side. It doesn't matter. Some people use wood. Some people use acrylic in the same size. It just has to be exactly 4 inches. It can be square around, and it can't be more than 1/8 of an inch thick for it to fit inside the apparatus that we have. So, in past years, we would have pieces that completely came off the wall, and, you know, some pieces that actually had like 2 feet of pieces that came out of the coaster. But to as we've continued to do the show over the years, we've sort of refined it into getting it to something that's easy to manage, that's very uniform in concept and beautiful, and allows people to kind of do what they do without reinventing the wheel. What I hate about a lot of group shows is that a lot of group shows are themed. And I feel as a gallerist and as, you know, somebody who runs a collective, that if you make somebody kind of conform to a theme and it doesn't sell, it will, you know, at that show, it's going to be something that they're going to have possibly forever. And, you know, I see a lot of these pop culture theme shows, you know, where there's like 50 paintings from The Big Lebowski. And I'm thinking, you know, what's this person going to do when, you know, the audience for The Big Lebowski have had their fill of, you know, however many pieces that is, in most cases, probably one. And, you know, what are they going to do with that? They'll put the effort into painting a piece that they'll then just kind of have in under a bed, in a closet, you know, in an architectural drawer. And most people, a lot of artists are afraid to destroy their work or to paint over it. I don't share that mindset. I think that if the piece doesn't work, it doesn't work, and why keep it? But, yeah, I like to be as accommodating as possible in that respect. You know, the only concept being a size restriction, I guess.
So you're the owner and director of Gallery 30 South in Pasadena, right?
Yep. Pasadena, California, not Pasadena, Texas. And, big distinction. And I also ran La Luz de Jesus Gallery for 10 years, basically from 2009 to 2019, I guess, almost. And, before that I had worked at that same gallery, on Melrose, 1990 to 1995 as a gallery manager, not as a director. And lots of interesting stories between those two tenures for sure. But it's been interesting, you know, coming back as a director at a very well-known gallery in, you know, and for the same person I had worked for when I was, you know, a teenager, really, honestly, and kind of take the reins and sort of manage it through a really tumultuous period, which was, you know, through the financial collapse. And bring it back to, you know, a kind of legendary status, and then have another endeavor to be able to kind of roll right into was nice.
Yeah. So how did you become a gallerist? I mean, I hear you describing the progression of your career, but where did the interest come from?
I was a kid who always drew. I'm the youngest of six, but there's a really big gap between you know, the oldest and youngest. So, and even like my closest siblings, golly, how old is my brother now? I think just a 16-year gap.
Okay. I got I'm the oldest of eight, and my oldest sister is 23 years older than I am. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is pretty nuts. My parents were actually initially told that they could never conceive. My oldest brother and oldest sister were adopted, and then they realized they could conceive and had four more kids over the years. But the we all look alike, which is really strange. I don't know if that's, you know, a nurture versus nature argument to be had.
That's interesting.
But we do look alike, even though we're not related, and well, not blood related. And, you know, I'm pretty close with my older brother, although we, you know, there was a large difference in the middle, and we didn't really get to know each other until we were both adults. But I was left to myself a lot, and so I would draw. We had a great set of Collier's encyclopedias in the house I grew up in. And my parents didn't really, they weren't like art collector types. You know, neither one of them went to college. My dad was, went straight into the military. My mother actually married him right before he shipped out for the Korean War. And, I believe it was in the ship going across the sea, the waves were tumultuous, and he was on guard duty upstairs because there were a lot of people who had never been in a boat before. And we grew up, you know, around the water. So a lot of these, you know, first time sailors and army guys were just like puking down in the ship. And so, you know, why anybody that was smart would volunteer for guard duty topside. And my dad did, and the ship got tossed, and he suffered a really bad head injury, and they ended up sending him to a hospital in Europe. So he spent most of the war in Europe. And so I found out, and this is years later I found this out, I think it was maybe even after my dad had passed away in 2001, I found out that my parents had lived in Paris for 2 years.
Hmm.
I mean, it's amazing to me that I didn't know that earlier, and seemingly
yeah,
not.
It seems
none of
like
my
that'd be a highlight,
either.
Right? That they would tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There'd be tons of pictures, you know, and there was, I had seen a couple pictures. There's a picture that they took with Peter Lorre on the streets of Paris. And I thought that was just their honeymoon. You know, I didn't realize they lived there. But there was one big art book that we had in the house that was sort of a survey of fine art, and there was a lot of Rococo work in there, which I really respected. And we had three paintings in the house that were master copies. So there was a Botticelli master copy of Madonna and Child, and my gosh, I think I don't even know who did the other paintings now that I think of it. And I'm sure they were on a label on the painting that I never paid attention to, because if I was looking at the artwork, I would get lost in the artwork and didn't spend a lot of time reading about the work. And I sort of felt like the idea of writing about art when you could just look at it was kind of crazy. And then, of course, later became a film critic and an art critic. So, you know, I guess my hypocrisy has certain bounds. But the, you know, what I realized early on was I had a great appreciation for illustrators. And so that was kind of the type of art that I did. Definitely growing up as a kid in the '70s in, you know, north of Boston, that there was not a lot of encouragement of abstract expressionist paintings.
Right.
If I had shown any kind of gift for it, I'm sure that the other kids in my class would have relentlessly barraged, you know, anybody who would endeavor in that with, why doesn't that look like anything? And certainly the kid would have changed their style. But it wasn't even encouraged. And so I didn't really become knowledgeable or even introduced to much abstract expressionism until much, much later in life. And it's funny because I've kind of got a great appreciation for minimalism, but most of my early formative years were really rooted in illustration and love of comic books and movie poster art and that whole stuff. And I think I didn't sleep much. So, I would sneak into the TV room and turn on the TV at night and watch whatever was on from, you know, the point where my parents had already gone to sleep until before they woke up in the morning, and functioned myself on like a couple hours of sleep for basically 20 years.
Wow. You know, you mentioned the Collier's Encyclopedia. when I was a kid, I always wished we had a set, but I would just sit in the library on Saturdays at times and just go through the encyclopedia. I loved it. And it's interesting because, you know, they basically don't exist anymore. I mean,
yeah, there's not a lot of need anymore. Yeah. And it's funny because what we do have, Wikipedia, is so riddled with errors. I mean, there's great information, you know, there's way more information than we ever had access to. And recently, a couple years ago, there's a great artist who's represented by a gallery in Washington, D.C., and he printed out Wikipedia, like the entire Wikipedia to that point, and had an art installation of all these books, of Wikipedia books, and I bought one of the volumes that had the word appropriation in it. That was the one that I wanted.
That's great.
I have volume one of, you know, 750 volumes probably of Wikipedia. But the thing about the encyclopedias, though, is, of course, you need to update them, right? Because the information changes, and especially in the era where I grew up, I was, you know, born in 1971, and, you know, I remember that there were yearbooks that came with the encyclopedias too, and so my parents subscribed to the yearbooks. So rather than update the set, they would just get like a new single volume sized book that was that year's event every year from 1964 until after I had already, you know, left the house and moved to California, so easily into 1989. And it was interesting to go back and look at entries where you knew information had changed. And so I was also very fascinated with science. Was not a lover of math, but really, really loved science. And when you'd look up information about certain things, there was so much that was still inconclusive. Mm. You know, when these encyclopedias were published in 1960 or 61, I mean, we hadn't gone to the moon yet.
Yeah.
So a lot of the information that was in there about the planets and distance, I was getting, you know, I had a subscription to Discover magazine when that was brand new. And, you know, I'd be getting all this information about the cosmos and different scientific endeavors that completely contradicted what had been in the encyclopedias. And my father and I were very fond of arguing about everything. And so we would have these little bets, you know, we would bet like a quarter or 50 cents here and there on stuff. And he would swear by whatever was in those encyclopedias, even if new information had come out that this sort of contradicted it. And I found that incredibly frustrating. But so we would often have a stalemate in many of our arguments.
Yeah. My dad, when I was a kid, one of the things that I really loved, my mom and dad always subscribed to Reader's Digest, which I think still exists, but
I believe it does.
Yeah. But and Reader's Digest would, you know, publish something called Reader's Digest Condensed Books, and, you know,
abridged versions of books. Yeah.
Yeah. And like four books in one bound copy. And, you know, when my dad started purchasing those, he must have gotten some kind of deal. And, you know, the gift that came with that purchase was the equivalent of about a ream of paper. But it was all photographs, not photography paper. It was just on plain paper, but they're black and white old photographs of Ulysses S. Grant and Walt Whitman, and, you know, just it. And there were Native Americans and famous people from basically the beginning of photography.
Wow.
And I would just sit and go through those for hours. And, and I, you know, there's so many times I've thought about, I wished I had some of those prints so that I could frame them. And, you know, I've always loved stuff like that. You know, I think it sounds like you and I have that in common. The print media thing is just something I've always been in love with.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that also, you know, the tangible quality of anything like that, books especially, I think, were a huge avenue of escape for me as well. So the, you know, I would sit and read the, I read the encyclopedia from the first volume to the last volume. It took me probably 7 years, but, you know, I did read every single entry, and the, I didn't understand it all. You know, right. I was quite young when I started, but I did read through it, and, you know, where I felt like, it was something that I wasn't going to be particularly interested in, I wouldn't go back and look. But we also, the other thing that Collier's had was a 2-volume dictionary. And so I could go in and check any word that I didn't know, and generally would do that as well. And I just remember we moved the bookcase that the books were in from one side of the hallway to the other side of the hallway. And when it went from, we'll say, the north side of the hallway to the south side of the hallway, it was right next to my parents' bedroom, and I'd always have like at least 2 or 3 open at any given time, because I would have the encyclopedia that I was reading open, and it would reference something from another volume. So I'd probably have that other volume open, and then I would have the dictionary open, and then I would probably have one of the yearbooks if it was, you know, something recent, or even if there was a recent architectural discovery that I had been aware of, you know, in the 70s when the King Tut exhibition was sort of traveling, again, from the Field Museum in Chicago to other museums. I saw it in the Boston Museum of Science. And then a couple years later, you know, I would say probably 1985 or 86, it was the Ramses II exhibition. And, we got there early enough to actually see them floating these gigantic Egyptian monoliths on barges down the Charles River to load into the back end of the museum. So that was kind of an incredible thing to see, you know, as a teenager at that point, you know, these ancient, gigantic, you know, sculptures, you know, human-made sculptures, probably made with, you know, an incalculable cost of human suffering by a slave workforce. But the fact that they were these just incredible things, and when you were in the exhibition, they were huge. If you hadn't seen the come in, you'd probably wonder how the hell they get these in here.
Right.
You know, like, how do you deliver a gigantic statue from Egypt? And we realized, of course, that they put them on barges and floated them down the river, probably the same way they did them originally.
Yeah. Wow. So, so the gallery, where would you say it fits in the world of modern art? Like the type of product, for lack of a better word. I'm sure there is a better word, but I don't have one.
So the gallery that I run, or gallery writ large as a concept.
Yeah. The one that you have, you know, where are you?
So where we're at, so Gallery 30 South, in Pasadena, means we're outside of LA, but we're about 20 minutes from downtown LA. Mm-hmm. Pasadena is also a kind of, affluent suburb, if you will. It's its own city. We have our own health department. So, which is how we're able to have different regulations than the entire rest of LA County. It was a primarily sort of WASPy, you know, white area. And then in probably the 1930s, the demographic became somewhat highly populated by African Americans. And then in the 1970s and 80s, the population of Asians grew and then doubled and then tripled, so that San Gabriel Valley, which is just to the south of us, is the largest pocket population of Chinese outside of China.
Wow.
And the food is incredible over here. It's not a mistake why we live here. My wife is Japanese. And so there has to be, you know, we have to be close to a Japanese grocery store. She's a SIAC grad who makes jewelry, who's also a sushi chef. So she's like a multi-didact as well. And, you know, it's very important that we have access to all types of culture that we both kind of need in our lives. So where the gallery sort of fits in out here is interesting, because we're not on the main street. We're sort of part of a neighborhood that's called the Green Street, Green Street Village Landmark District. And so the logo on our district sign is Albert Einstein, because if I'm standing in the corner of my gallery, I can see the corner of a building that was his office, you know, in the 1930s. So his office was here. Right around the corner was the Office of Naval Intelligence, which was developing the Manhattan Project. There's a lot of Germanic looking houses from massive emigration from, you know, the Weimar Republic of Germany before the Nazis took over. They moved here early on. There's and then of course afterwards there were a lot of Germans that were brought over by the military to work for Jet Propulsion Laboratories, which is also here in Pasadena. So it's an interesting city to be in because it's at this crossroads of not just culture, but of history. So there's the Theosophical societies that flourished here. You know, there was very famously Jack Parsons, who helped develop the American rocket program, was from Pasadena. And he was also the envoy to the Golden Dawn, which was, you know, the society in England that Aleister Crowley had made famous, and Israel Regardi and famous sort of occultists like that, Madame Blavatsky. And so their official headquarters in the United States was Jack Parsons' house. And then you got like all these kind of Rosicrucian crosses that are built into some of the window panes, you know, up and down Walnut Street. And you've got the Devil's Gate Dam, where supposedly Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard had a Gemini working with a young woman, and maybe even possibly, if you believe some of the legends, George Bush's grandmother. But when you get really, really outside the box here, it's just a really beautiful city that has a lot of strange stuff that is perfect to have an edgy gallery. So we've got, you know, the Norton Simon Museum, we've got the Huntington Library. And so where we sort of fit in is that we can kind of get away with anything. You know, like the show we have up right now is cartoony type artwork with an artist named Juan Muniz, who's a muralist and tattooist out of Las Vegas, who's won numerous toy awards for characters that he's created that sort of look a bit like, or they look perfect for like the Pops toys that you see everywhere. And the show that we have up are pages from paintings that are pages to a book that he wrote for kids that help parents and children talk about depression. So, you know, this, the character is sort of has no expression on his face. So the circumstances kind of dictate the emotion. And so it's an easy kind of opening to be able to talk about, you know, intense feelings that aren't always easy to talk about. So, you know, it's, while it's kind of cute, it's also not necessarily the type of thing that everybody wants to hang on their walls. So when we do a show like this, we do so knowing that it's possible we won't sell anything, but that it's something that we believe in strongly enough that it fits in the sort of long-term timeline of the shows that we've done here, which have, you know, included incredibly political shows like In Decline exhibition. We gave the first, like, really solo exhibition in Southern California to Torben Ulrich, who's a national treasure of Denmark, as a sports, as an athlete, and as a painter, as a proponent of jazz. As one of the youngest sort of satellite members of the Cobra Collective, and as the father of future Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich. So, you know, we really do kind of cover a lot of ground there, and sometimes it's insulation and kind of hard for, you know, a layperson to maybe penetrate. But because the gallery isn't huge and because you have to kind of, you have to intend to come here. Like, you would never just, we do get occasionally people walk by and they're like, "Hey, I didn't know there's a gallery here." But, generally those people are open to a gallery experience. Whereas if we were in downtown, you know, Old Town Pasadena, we would be bombarded with tourists who would scratch their heads, have very little respect for the work on the walls. And probably, you know, if it were a situation where I had, you know, a gallery assistant who was running the space for me, it would probably drive them crazy. But, you know, we're unique in that way. We're small enough that we can sort of function outside the system, but we're also showing enough notable people that we get attention. When I ran La Luz de Jesus in Los Feliz, we were a famous gallery, but getting coverage was really tough because we were seen as a gallery inside a shop. Mm. And I always made the argument that sort of the opposite was true. The shop was this explosion outside of the gallery that was really this incredibly curated assembly piece by a guy named Billy Shire. And, you know, when people always ask, you know, who's the most important reason why I own a gallery, it's absolutely because I worked for Billy Shire. You know, and luckily he's still with us, and I hope he lives to be 100. But, you know, the impact that he's had on fine art has been tremendous, but it's also hard to gauge because he's never been one of those guys that kind of, you know, tooted his own horn. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of copied that a bit, but I've also been smart enough that, or I should say savvy enough that I think I understand that every once in a while I do have to kind of, you know, yell my name to the sky and hope somebody hears it.
So what would you say, and if you don't want to answer this, obviously don't, but just to give people an idea of the cost of pieces that are sold, what would you say is the priciest, or what was the highest amount that someone has spent on a piece that has gone through your gallery?
When I ran La Luz de Jesus, I sold the Joe Soren painting for $55,000. And a couple of pieces that were in the $20,000 to $30,000 range in that same show, and occasionally could do that. Out here, I've sold comic art, you know, to the tune of a single sale for probably $75,000. And there was a show at La Luz de Jesus where I sold over $500,000 worth of mid-century tiki restaurant fixtures. It was like a giant tiki themed show. We published a book about it. And so that's kind of that would be my record and the record of that gallery. Here, I would say if there's a sweet spot, it's somewhere between $1,000 and $6,000.
Okay.
But I can still occasionally sell pieces for more than that, and we sell a lot of stuff for less than that. Mm. I mean, in the coaster show, there are pieces that were like $10 and $20. And, you know, sometimes there are free pieces. You know, when you've got 664 pieces on the walls, you can stick a couple of pieces in there that are zero that, you know, people really have to look to see that they're free. And then they can just walk over and say, you know, I want that one. And they can, you know, we take down the name, they can have it at the end of the show. And so that's a kind of nice little treat for people who are diligent. And we don't generally put the free coasters on the website, so it's only for people that come in and see it.
That's really cool that you do that. So it's, you know, you have some affordable fine art.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say is the sweet spot in terms of your audience? What type of people are we talking about in terms of what they do for a living? And
I get a lot of Hollywood people. You know, that means a lot of things, and probably to people outside of LA means less. But a lot of people who work on films who aren't necessarily on camera, but also a lot of people who direct and act, and we get musicians. I was talking to somebody last week about, you know, the demographic here, and it's, you know, everybody from SoundCloud rappers that I've never heard of that are probably really popular with your nieces and nephews, to, you know, people like Johnny Depp or Kevin Smith. Mm-hmm. So, it's a pretty broad spectrum of people who shop here. And again, because we're not really in the middle of a busy retail area, people have to kind of make the effort to come out here to see shows. So like a lot of galleries, we had been doing probably more business online. And of course, during the pandemic, it was almost all the business was online. We didn't sell too many pieces to people who came in person at all. And, you know, when we end this call later, I'll go right back to putting stuff up for, you know, our sort of small business Saturday, Artist Sunday sale that we have every year, which are pieces that, come from the collections of my collectors, you know, people who have for one reason or another decided to divest from certain pieces in their collections. So it gives people a chance to get some really great stuff very affordably. The only rules I have is that it can't be marked less than it was marked originally. Mm. So that it has to be an upwardly mobile piece, meaning that it's increased in value from when it was first exhibited and we don't necessarily sell it at peak value to what that artist's latest pieces might cost, but it still allows somebody to pick up some great work for probably less than they would expect to pay.
Hmm.
But like the show that I have up right now, for the Wamanese pieces, the cheapest piece in the show is $550, and the most expensive piece is $950. Hmm. So that's pretty affordable.
Yeah. So I grew up in Indiana, and I've been in Florida for 24 years now. And one of the first jobs I had, I live in Palm Beach County. You know, I love art. So I wanted to work at a gallery. So I did. It was pretty short lived, but I don't know. Have you ever been to Palm Beach? Do you know what that's like? I mean,
I know the West Palm Beach Group, who are a convention consortium that run probably 15 art shows a year.
Yeah, there's Art Palm Beach, and then there's the Palm Beach Fine Art and Antique Show, which mm-hmm. is huge. Really cool show at the convention center. And a lot of Palm Beach galleries exhibit at those. It's kind of their prime time of year. But you know, there are some, this gallery that I worked in was a really high end gallery. And, I worked doing installations. I have a little bit of a carpentry background. So, you know, I was working for a guy who wanted to rehang the gallery like three times a week. Mm-hmm. So I was doing a lot of that, but you know, really, I was eager to learn. That's why I wanted to do it. You know, I knew about, you know, the classic artists, you know, the Impressionists and, you know, Renaissance art and all that stuff. But I didn't really know anything about modern art. And so it was a perfect opportunity for me to learn because, you know, he'd say, I want the Dubuffet over there. Or, you know, the Longo over there. And I had to know. So what I actually did is I went out and bought, there's, you know, I'm sure you've seen it, the art book. And it's similar.
Oh, the fashion book?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And I got a little hand copy of it. And, you know, it has a clear enough example of every artist in there that you can recognize that artist's work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I caught on pretty quickly and, it was, you know, like I said, it was short lived, but it was a really cool experience to have. And it just enriched my life, you know, and that's generally, I think what art, music, that's what they do. That's the purpose they serve. You know, they make the rest of it, the toil worthwhile, right? I mean,
that's what aesthetic is, yeah, and why it's so hard to put a value to it. So if someone enjoys art, then they understand value, and they may understand that some pieces cost more than they can afford to spend, but they understand that there is an actual value, that it's not strictly intrinsic. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of people who don't understand that, and there's so many factors that can lead to that being the case. And it can just be that, you know, that there was no value put upon anything that wasn't considered to be, you know, a life or death issue in the household. You know, my parents were both quite old. They grew up during Great Depression. And, you know, so I grew up in a household where you had to eat everything on your plate because they were so used to not having anything to eat. You know, and that type of stuff. We won't talk about the dietary problems that probably caused my siblings and I for the rest of our lives. But, that kind of mindset of, you know, feast or famine, I think is going to be a mindset again soon. There's a lot of, payments that aren't going to be made in January that are going to cause a lot of foreclosures across the United States. And that's going to cause another, you know, type of Great Depression like we saw in 2008. And, you know, this one's really soon after the last one, which is, you know, shocking. But, you know, if we've grown up in that, I think that the frivolity of purchasing is a little bit different than it was. I think what happened is that instead of things that were deemed unnecessary, you know, for whatever reason, becoming less expensive, everything else got more expensive. So rather than, you know, these things that were completely unnecessary being out of reach and being avoided, general necessities have gotten so much more expensive that those sort of treats aren't that much more anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, like it used to be, I can buy, you know, this really well-painted contemporary art piece, or I can buy a used car. You know, like that's kind of how you could think about it. When I was selling pieces that were $6,000, $8,000, and $10,000, I'd look at that and think, well, geez, you know, if I bought this, you know, for retail price, I could buy this, or I could, you know, buy my wife a better used car or something. Mm-hmm. And I think most people think logically like that. And I think maybe they don't even think in those terms. They think this is a month's rent, or this is 2 months rent. And I mean, now like rent here in California, that painting is a lot less month's rent than it used to be.
Right.
And so because of that, people can calculate, they can say, well, shoot, you know, if I match my rent money for a couple of months, then I can buy this thing. And they start thinking, oh wow, this is more doable than I ever thought it was. So it's kind of funny that while other things have gotten more expensive, a lot of art hasn't. I mean, there's, you know, people have become superstars. And so, you know, there's people like Banksy at the top of the food chain, and there's a lot of people in the middle. And then there's, you know, affordable stuff that you can pick up at an art fair or, you know, in a small gallery. But that aesthetic thing, to me, I've always seen, I would get a lot of people who would buy things and they expect it to go up in value the way that a stock may go up in value. But as we know, stocks don't always go up in value. Stocks sometimes go down in value. And so a painter can do things that will hurt their market, but they don't care about the price of their old work, generally speaking.
Right.
You know, so they're not thinking about legacy. They're not worried that when their artwork hits a certain point, that people who bought stuff super cheap 10 years ago are going to flood the market with it. Mm. And it's going to compete in price with the stuff that they're painting for their next show. They just don't think about that. No one's ever taught them to.
Right.
So those types of, you know, small economics are things that people have to pay attention to. But, you know, what has been interesting is that the value of entry-level artwork has probably gone up a few hundred dollars, but the distance that your money goes has gotten less, so that you can buy a gym membership or you can buy a piece that will hang on your wall for 20 years. Mm. You know, if you have a piece in your house and it hangs on your wall for 2 years, say, you can figure out if it gives you joy the entire time it's up. And I don't know any people that generally leave things only in the walls for 2 years, but, you know, things tend to stay longer. But, you know, if you use 2 years as an increment, or use 5 years as an increment, you can break down how much you paid for that over time by assessing how much it costs you per day to look at it. Mm. You know, if I paid $500 and it was up for 5 years, it cost me $100 a year to look at it, which is, you know what, it's less than $1.
Right.
You know, it's super cheap. You know, it's less than a parking meter for 15 minutes in, you know, downtown Los Angeles. So if you think about things in relative terms, then the value of any kind of art is going to be very, very affordable for the benefit that you get from it. Mm. And like you say, it's sort of, you know, it's that chicken soup for the soul. It's something that you want to look at because it makes you feel something. Not everybody wants to be surrounded by, you know, art that makes them feel good. Some people want to surround themselves with art that makes them feel bad because they use it as a kind of, I don't know, a guilt motivator of, you know, I've done really well, and so I need to think about other things. I want to look at this bad thing. Or, you know, some people collect, you know, photographs of war or photographs of intense moments, and they hang them in their house. And sometimes they hang it to get a rise out of people that visit. You know, sometimes they hang it to keep their in-laws from visiting, you know, to keep other people from bringing children into their apartments. But, you know, all, anything that you live around serves a purpose beyond its functionality. You know, if you have a super, super ugly chair in your living room, I bet it's a really, really, really comfortable, ugly chair. Yeah. And the reason you haven't gotten rid of it is because you get more pleasure from sitting in it than you care about deriding from it, from sitting in it and looking at some other object. So you're not going to look at it yourself. And it takes somebody else walking into that room who doesn't sit in that chair to try and change your mind about getting rid of that chair. So when you want to upgrade, you have to figure out, okay, what's the most comfortable chair that I can aesthetically live with? You know, and so these choices tend to change with every new object we bring in. And, you know, you hear that, that old adage constantly, the thing that people who run galleries hate, which is, you know, you show somebody a painting and they say, oh, that's going to look great over my couch, or I don't want that piece because it doesn't match my couch. Right. You know, and you're kind of thinking like, maybe they're thinking about it backwards, but, you know, that's that person's decision. That's what's motivating them. Some people just want to have an object that people can recognize, you know, like the reason why people like Banksy and artwork that looks like Banksy artwork has gotten big with younger people is because of the value of the meme. And so Instagram and the easy spreading of, you know, viral images, that you've got bragging rights if you actually have that piece hanging on your wall. It's an addition. And that's kind of what Warhol was addressing in him doing silk screens and doing, you know, hundreds of pieces as an addition, you know, as a factory painter, literally, you know, having people paint these pieces for him or do the screens for him. And the idea that everybody could assess the value because they knew what it was. And they not only knew the painter's name, but more importantly, they knew who the painting was of, that he had changed an iconic image enough to make it his own while still making a value of such from the image of the person he painted. So that's still happening. You know, people still paint celebrities. People still paint famous moments. And they do so because they want to connect with people who maybe don't connect with their work. So there's that secondary level. And it's easier than learning allegory.
Yeah.
And I don't begrudge it. You know, I think that simplicity is great. And I love like iconography. You know, Panic Collective, we're all about iconography. But we also add in, you know, 2, 3, 4 levels. But you don't need to understand that to enjoy it.
Yeah. So would you say, you know, as being someone who owns a gallery and you have people walking in and out and purchasing things, what percentage would you say, what's the breakdown of people who buy something because they attach some sort of meaning to it, and those other people like you're talking about who it's either status or they think they'll, it'll look good in their home or, you know, how's
overall that's going to be different. So, you know, every gallery is going to have a different clientele. A lot of galleries that have large clienteles and they know that they can have a show and they can pretty much rely upon selling, say, 30 to 40% of the pieces in the show on a regular basis. They've built up a roster of probably showing a lot of artists who look alike. So, you know, I don't want to name a gallery, but there's a gallery here that was started by a TV producer and his wife were collectors. And so they started just offering shows to the people whose paintings they bought from other galleries. And then they started buying every piece in the show. And it turned into kind of, instead of a consignment model, which is most galleries, they bought pieces and then sold them. So once the artist was paid, they could price it whatever they wanted. And so that would cause problems if they bought a piece for, say, $1,000 and then turned around and marked $5,000 on the wall.
Right.
Now, if they did sell it for $5,000, that's great. They made a 4-to-1 profit, but the model is usually 50-50. And it also messes up that artist's prices at their next gallery show. You know, not many gallerists or not many artists show at only one gallery. There are exclusive deals and relationships between some artists and some galleries, but most of the people that show in galleries have a gallerist maybe in LA, maybe in New York, maybe in London, maybe in Tokyo. Like they're showing other places, or they're at least putting pieces in group shows. And so if you've just completely blown the market price on someone's work by getting a lot of money for a piece, other gallerists aren't going to be able to show them because their clientele has been used to getting those pieces for a lot cheaper. And then you have to maintain that. So you can't just sell one piece for a lot more money. You have to start pricing everything that high. And so if the audience for that artist doesn't follow, you've ruined their career. And and it happened to some of the artists that they showed. Again, people I will not name, but that they were like, oh man, I love showing with them. They buy every piece of my show. You know, so they got paid, you know, to show up at a party, you know, where everybody's like, oh, you're so amazing. You sold everything. And then 2 weeks later, the red dots come off the walls and some pieces are for sale. And then 6 months later, some pieces are for sale. And, so people don't believe the hype. And then, you know, it's weirdly, you know, the art world is sort of a faith-related business. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, faith in any kind of almighty, but it's a faith in the market, you know, in the same way that, you know, currency says in God we trust, that it has a value that people have agreed upon, you know, for whatever reason. And we build a pricing system around it. At a certain level in the business of selling paintings or sculptures or editions or, you know, designer toys or what have you, there's a general agreement that a thing is worth a certain amount of money. And when there's a massive change to that, there's usually a backlash. And that backlash is either followed with a massive reinvestment of a new wave of investors, or it's a desertion of collectors. So I've seen artists' pricing get manipulated too quickly by gallerists, and then see massive sell-offs by people who bought their pieces super cheap, who are seeing a chance to cash in. And what they don't understand is if they sort of all held on to those and sort of like brought one piece out, you know, every 6 months or so, they'd all make more money. But what happens is they all, for whatever reason, hit the market at the same time. And that flood in the market usually causes problems for that artist's next show. We saw it happen with an artist named Shag back in 2009, where about the same time he had a show at a rival gallery. He had dropped a show with his gallery of note, and they ended up having a show anyways with pieces from different collectors and selling it. And so there were two Shag shows happening the same month within 2 miles. Interestingly enough, both shows did okay. Like, it was different enough work, and you know, there wasn't an intention of the original gallery to do him harm, but he had dropped a show. You know, and you know, they calculate, you know, their entire calendar. Like, I can show somebody in January and February that isn't going to do well if my March show does well, and it should. And then I can go 2 more months with not, you know, showing who I want to sell, who maybe the public isn't ready for, if on that next 3rd month we have a massive success. So, you know, a smart gallerist has to plan that into their schedule and say, okay, I need to make money here and I need to make money here to keep the doors open. And I don't have to make so much money in these other months because these other shows will tide me through. And at some level, you know, in a corporate level gallery and a Gagosian or something like that, I mean, every show has to make money. You know, they're deciding not to show, like, they don't have a vision that's based around aesthetic. They have a market.
Right.
And that's very different. So the blue chip art world and, you know, the usual neighborhood gallery world are very, very different. You can do things that are similar in both models, certain things that both are advised to do, but the client base is very, very different. I occasionally will sell pieces to people who buy blue chip artwork because they see something in the work and they're like, man, I don't care if nobody else buys this, I'm buying this because sooner or later someone's going to catch on. And so we've seen that with quite a few artists. I've got a few people that have, you know, Basquiat's in their collections and, you know, some really expensive work. But, you know, you look at a collector like Johnny Depp, and he just started buying almost exclusively self-taught work and entry-level work years ago. And it was as a result of doing Edward Scissorhands and Vincent Price, you know, being on set. And Vincent Price was a massive patron of the arts, but most especially a patron of Native American painters and Latinos. So, you know, he was a really strong proponent of saying, you can put your money wherever you want and you can buy beautiful things. But if you can buy beautiful things that change the life of the person who made it, that's probably a better use of your money. And that was something I think that, that Depp took to heart. He has a fantastic, you know, collection of what some people would pejoratively call outsider art that, you know, some people call visionary art or self-taught. And, yeah, it maybe isn't as valuable as perhaps, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's collection, but, I'm sure he loves every piece that's in it. And I'm sure it's all hanging.
Yeah. You know, I've had an opportunity to have some pretty great artists on this podcast who just, you know, really are relatively unknown. And some of them seem to do pretty well for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they have a style and it's something unique and, you know, it's to me, one of the things that when there's a sort of a trademark look of an artist, I mean, that says something to me, you know, if it's visually pleasing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even if it's not, you know, like if you're the one person who does ugly, you know, and people can recognize that ugly, you'll work forever. You know, it's what are the three tenets, you know, that, that Neil Gaiman had said, it's like, you know, if you have talent and you're a nice person and you always deliver on time, you'll always work, but you really only need any two of those. So, you know, like if you're a nice person and you have talent, you can deliver late. If you're a nice person and you deliver on time, you don't necessarily have to be that talented. If you're talented and you deliver on time, you can be a total bastard. You know, so it's kind of like any two legs on that tripod will work. And I think in the art world, what I've realized over time is that there's probably a slightly different equation that also applies, but that applies too. And I've decided years ago that while it's fun to break a new artist, and I'm certainly capable of getting pieces into museum collections on occasion, it's super tough, but it's something I still endeavor to do. You know, I got Chuck D into a museum. I'm working on getting some pieces by a former coworker of mine named Lydia Breckenridge, who's an African-American woman in retirement age who does these great quilts, but she was also like a real LA punk rocker in the 70s, you know, and so her quilts have this kind of lineage that goes from the original African-American art form, which is the original American art form, the African-American quilt, that runs all the way through punk rock. So she does like, you know, the Clash, you know, in lettering on quilts. And I've been working for about 2.5 years now to get her pieces into two museums. And I keep getting a yes, and it just keeps taking forever to happen. Yeah. But I decided that what was really more important to me was showing work that I like, yeah, but people that I want to work with, you know, that I'm not going to work with somebody who's super difficult just because I can sell their work. It's not worth it. You know, that at this point in my life, you know, as I'm closing in on 50, that I just don't have time, you know, for that stuff. And there's just too many people that are really, really nice who I really want to see succeed that need just a little bit of help, you know, and it just takes, you know, one gallery to shine a little light on them. And I've done it for probably literally thousands of people at this point, you know, with all the shows that I've curated at Lolis de Jesus and here and in museums and in art fairs, that literally thousands of people have had their very first show with me, and literally thousands of people have bought their very first piece of art for me. And I think that I'm probably head and shoulders above whoever's number two on that list. You know, I think that by virtue of the price point of what we sell, it's a little bit easier for me to do that than, you know, maybe the assistant at Gagosian. But, you know, it's also the amount of pleasure that buyer gets from that work is incredibly important to me. I don't want to sell a piece to somebody who's not going to want it, you know, 2 hours after, you know, they open their Visa bill. Like, I want them to really love the piece. I'm not somebody who's a hard sell guy. Mm-hmm. I'll give them a reason to buy it. You know, I'll walk them through and I'll say, well, what do you like? And then if they like it and they can't decide between two pieces, I'll give them an opinion. But at the end of the day, I'm not here to force my taste on anyone. I've already done it by hanging it in the wall.
Right.
And, you know, it's not one painting. So, you know, the idea is really to give opportunity to people, because that makes me happy. That one of the things that I learned, you know, early on, and I mean not early on, like as a kid in elementary school, you know, drawing something and a kid sitting next to me could draw it better. And me giving him, you know, 15 cents to buy a bag of chips, that's, I guess that proves that I'm almost 50, you know, from the school lunches, and him giving me that drawing and me saving it. And, you know, making little drawings myself of classmates and teachers in, you know, various inappropriate situations and selling those for 50 cents and a buck. That I have like a context to it. I wasn't just the guy that kind of took a corporate attitude towards selling art or something, that I was somebody who did create art, but I also recognized that there were a lot of people who did everything better than me. You know, I can do a lot. I can do pottery and sculpture. I can draw pretty well. I can paint fairly well. I hate watercolor and I stay away from it. I also have no patience for charcoal, but every other discipline I can do it. You know, if I were to draw you something, you'd be like, oh, it's pretty good, you know, but you wouldn't say, oh my gosh, you know, this should be the cover of a Marvel comic, or, oh my gosh, you know, this should be hanging in the Louvre. So what I do, and having actually gotten a piece in the Louvre, is I work with other people. And so I love working with collectives. I love collaboration. I consider my chief job as a curator to be a collaborator in chief, you know, that frequently I have a lot of conversations with some artists, not all, about, you know, what they should do. Because a lot of people are fantastic technicians, great craftsmen, can execute well, and just don't know what to draw or paint. And they maybe have a little bit of vision of what they want to do, but they overthink it. They get a little bit outside their heads. Now, I'm not, you know, standing on their shoulder, you know, like an angel or devil telling them what to do, but I'll give them a few examples of what I think works and what doesn't, and let them deliver what they're going to deliver. And intuitively, I work well with a handful of people. And some of those people have reputations for being incredibly difficult with other galleries. But I've not found that to necessarily be the case for me. And I don't think I'm super patient. My mother, may she rest in peace, would laugh and scoff at the idea of me saying that I have patience. But I think I've certainly developed it over the years, and you kind of have to in this business. You know, when you've had shows dropped and you have to make a quick recovery, you know, also working in entertainment, and, you know, I ran my own studio for a while, licensing and releasing films. And I remember, you know, those early releases, everything had to be perfect. You know, if there was a comma instead of a period, you know, on a box wrap, you would call the printer and have them destroy it and have them print it again. Now I would never do that. It's like, you know, you kind of get over yourself. It's like, you realize that, yeah, some people are going to see that comma and they're going to, you know, make fun of you for it. But if they saw that comma, they already bought it. You know, honestly, like if they held that in their hands long enough that that's something that they noticed, they already owned it. And they didn't, you know, buy it or not buy it because there was a grammatical error. They either like the product or they don't like the product. And, you know, with things that are unique, that's a much more personal experience. And so it should be, and it technically is harder to sell paintings than it is to sell editions. But I spent so many years selling artwork that was as affordable as a print that it's really difficult for me to sell prints. You know, I created my own undoing in that respect. But, you know, I have massive respect for screen printing. You know, we have an artist that we'll be showing next month his main thing is screen printing. And there are pieces that have 30 screens on one piece because he's made a separate screen for every tattoo that he's put up and down, like, you know, a tattooed sleeve on, you know, a pop culture character. So, you know, that's a really, you know, neat kind of way of taking an obsessive way of looking at something, which is generous.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.